welcome to the Auto Movie Podcast, the only podcast on the internet, or one of three podcasts on the internet that might talk about cars and movies and online stuff like that. I'm Chris Ratcliffe. With me, as ever, is Martin Spain. And this episode is brought to you by Moist, the all-in-one meal box puzzle service. Tired of normal meals made with ingredients? Well, now enjoy something different, including teriyaki yak, moose, and pork belly jelly. 100% landfill, whale blubber-free since 2019, and now only containing trace amounts of squirrel. We are offering our listeners a unique 97% off your first 120 boxes of Moist. Just enter the discount code at checkout. That's spelt the normal way, for 97% off.
That's oddly specific. That's a very, very good ad read, sir, for a fictitious meal replacement bus service. This does remind me of the fake product that my friends used to talk about whenever we asked someone if they would like a Coca-Cola, where we'd be watching the Formula One or something like that, and someone would go, "Andy, Stotacola?" And Andy would nod his head, and then Tom would go to the kitchen and fetch him a Stotacola and present it to him with the tagline, "Stotacola, with the refreshing but surprising taste of weasel."
Please tell me somebody did a mock-up logo for that.
I don't think anyone ever did. It was just, I have no idea. It's the fact that stoat rhymes with Coke. And then when you're saying stoats, it's stoats and weasels. And, you know, it's all very, very silly. We should talk about cars. Welcome to episode 62. We're back off of our summer holidays and maybe a teeny bit punch drunk. It's very hot at the moment, so I'm going to put it down to a sunstroke.
Absolutely.
But yes, since we've last been going, it's been kind of quiet. It's been the August shutdown for Formula One. Not that that matters, because Max Verstappen is going to win every single race this season. So you don't need to watch the races. Just assume that he won. Anyway, let's move on to things that have been happening. The Motor Film Award nominations are out. I think we've talked about this every year for the last three or so years. It's usually quite interesting to see all these noms, because you get to see particularly short films that you might never have heard of before, and you can then hunt them down and watch them, and sometimes they can be really, really interesting things that you haven't heard of. It's also nice to see some of the big Hollywood films getting recognition for the vehicular work in there, the automotive mayhem in there. I always enjoy seeing those. I always enjoy seeing what sort of documentaries get called out, what online films get put forward by various outlets. Haggerty have put forward a couple of things. I think they're both Jason Kamisa films. No Henry Catchpole this time around, which is a bit of a crying shame, but we'll be talking about him later, as we always do. What I did notice was that there was no sign of Mission Impossible Dead Reckoning,
which really struck me, because seeing as they do have Fast X.
Yes, they do, and given that both of them feature car chases in Rome, one of which is really good and one of which is really shit, I feel like Mission Impossible's stunt team and automotive drivers have been a little hard done by there. So I was quite surprised to see that that wasn't in the noms, but maybe it didn't qualify because it was released too late or something. I don't know. Maybe it'll sneak in there next year. But having seen it again recently, I think that scene is absolutely mega. All of the vehicular work in these films is properly impactful in all of the ways, both the impacts the vehicles have with one another, but also off the screen, it puts you right in the car. So it's a bit of a shame for that. But there's some other stuff on there that I do want to go and check out. I do want to try and hunt down some of the shorts, and we will let you know when the winners are announced, although we are too small, too pikey to be actually invited to the ceremony.
Is there anything that jumps out at you looking through the nominations where you think, oh, that was particularly good?
Oh, now you're going to put me on the spot. I haven't got the nominations up in a tab. I'm going to have to do some live typing now. And I can't type motor film.
There was a few that kind of caught me as just like, really? It was that one? So, like, for example, The Grand Tour, A Scandi Flick is in there for best documentary episode. And there's a few of the Top Gear ones which aren't bad, but they're not necessarily the ones I'd put forward. But I mean, we say that every year.
I see that Gran Turismo has been nominated.
More on that later.
Ghosted, the quite crap movie from Dexter Fletcher. Now, I love Dexter Fletcher, and I think he's actually a really good director. But Ghosted on, I think, Apple TV was just a load of crap. And I like everybody involved. Like, Ana de Armas is a great actress. Really love Chris Evans. Again, you know, TV's Dexter Fletcher from Press Pack. these are the
specific
reference to someone who is as old as I am. I think he's really good, but Ghosted was not really good. Lamborghini, The Man Behind the Legend, I talked about that. It's rubbish. But Fast X, that's not that good. The Flash. The Grey Man, again, I don't know how you can nominate for that. The car stuff in that was not that good. And very heavily CG enhanced in a really obvious way. I know all of these have visual effects in there, and all of them make use of computers to either do rig removal or all manner of trickery. But usually it's brilliantly done when you don't know it's there. Whereas some stuff like The Grey Man and Fast X, it's just really obvious, like really, really, really obvious. And that takes you totally out of the film. You start going, hang on, am I watching, you know, Colin McRae Rally 2 on the PlayStation 2? This is terrible.
So I think for me, the Red Bull Ford Powertrains film was good. I do wonder with some of these whether it's not the car content necessarily, but it's kind of particularly in the best drama that, you know, Lamborghini, The Man Behind the Legend is a film about cars and motoring rather than a motoring film specifically.
Yeah, but I get that. And there is a fine line to walk between, is it good? I mean, that one, is it good filmmaking? Not especially. Mm. Are the car scenes in it brilliant? Also not especially. But I see what you're trying to say here. So there's some interesting best event film. I'd be quite interested in looking out the Formula E one for the Sao Paulo E-Prix because, you know, Sao Paulo is known for hosting great racing, and I find Formula E a bit of a mystery, and so I'd quite like to watch something about that and see if they can resell it to me, because I watched I don't think it was the finale, but I watched the race in London where they crowned the winner for this year. And it was just an unmitigated disaster of just...
It was awful.
The whole thing just felt so cheap and...
It was pokey. It was the real... So the thing with Formula E is that I think it can be genuinely good racing. And I know that it's easy to kind of poke holes at it because it makes it easy for people to do that. But the thing that struck me in London... It was that worst sort of Formula E track where it's tight and nadgery, and then it was half of it was an ice rink, the other half was dry, and it just wasn't their best.
Formula E for me is best when it's on a proper circuit, and I know these street circuits are kind of its USP. You know, you can bring it closer to the people, et cetera, et cetera. You can race indoors, which is, okay, that's kind of cool, but it also makes it look a bit like slightly larger radio control car racing.
Because
you don't get a lot of noise, you just get a bunch of sort of squeaking of the tyres and from the end, the PU.
The gearbox,
It's not that impressive, and I'm still not quite sure about it. But there's a bunch of other things on this list, like best event film. This is Le Mans. Quite interested in that. There's one that's just called Formula One. Like, what? All of it?
If you scroll down, I know which page you're on. If you scroll down, there is like a sentence or two for each one. So, like, for example, there's the Falcon Racing 24 Hours of Nürburgring film, that was good. Formula One is an F1 demonstration race at Suzuka.
Oh, I see. Yep, I see what you mean. There is a bunch of stuff there.
But yeah, I think I am going to try, and I say this every year, but I am going to try and actually watch some of these before the next episode, particularly, I think, some of the more esoteric stuff, because I'm genuinely interested, I mean, particularly with things like student films, the creative stuff, the stuff that's a bit less well known. I think it's easy for us, because we watch a lot of YouTube, to comment on some like the YouTube-y type categories. But I think there's a lot here, and I'd love to find more.
Best documentary feature, if that's not Villeneuve Peroni, I think there's some strong stuff here, but I think the Villeneuve Peroni thing was really good, really strong.
It was.
Also, foreshadowing what we might talk about next, Williams and Mansell, Red 5.
Yes.
That's an interesting one, which I'll talk about shortly. I want to try and hunt down this Chrysler Turbine car. So there's a film called, or documentary called, The Chrysler Turbine Car, Engineering a Revolution. And I love the idea of, like, American cars powered by really weird things like, you know, vegetables or nuclear fission.
Or steam.
Steam or turbines. You know, they went all in during the 60s to try and power cars with ever more weird things. And I love the idea of that, the engineering behind it, and the just, fuck it, let's just see what happens as they drop a jet engine into the back of a Chrysler.
Definitely.
There's something quite steampunk, backyard, skunk works about it, and that sounds quite interesting. So I'm going to hunt some of these down. I'm probably not going to go as hard in it as I know you will, but there are some really good ones in these documentary features. Go Fast, Risk Everything, Wild Story of Ken Block's 2022 Rally Title Chase. That's quite a long title. but yeah, there's some interesting stuff here. There's some really... I'd recommend everyone go to motorfilmawards.com/2023 and have a look at these nominations and have a see what you've seen and what you might be interested in seeing. And then we'll come back at some point in the not-too-distant future, hopefully, and we'll tell you who won. And we'll have a think about whether or not who we wanted to win actually won.
Speaking of films that might be up for awards next year, there's the trailer for, is it just called Ferrari?
I believe it is called Ferrari, yes. It's just on the teaser trailer, it just says Ferrari. So this is Michael Mann returning to direct a movie since 2015. So the last movie he made was 2015's Black Hat. And he hasn't made a really great film since Collateral in 2004, which is an absolute cracking movie. He's a really interesting director. You'll know him from things like Heat, amongst many others. But this is an intriguing teaser trailer. Adam Driver with dyed grey hair and sort of liver spots applied, but the top half of his head looks old enough and convincing enough, and then the bottom half of his head is just Adam Driver. So like 30-something chiseled Hollywood and a leading man. It's very weird. For me, he is such a distinctive-looking actor that I can't really stop going, hey, it's Adam Driver. that was my reaction. The whole thing was like, hey, that's Adam Driver. It's not like, oh my God, there's Enzo Ferrari. He's probably about to persuade one Ferrari driver to pit themselves against the other until both of them die. I'm just like, oh, it's Adam Driver. He was in that Star Wars movie. Because, you know, I am reductive and stupid. But what did you think of the trailer? Did you watch it and go, oh, I really want to see this? Because I know quite a lot of the internet did go, ooh, I really want to see this. And it's had pretty positive reviews. The film itself has just premiered at the Venice Film Festival, and the reviews have been pretty good. It opens on Christmas Day in the US. I don't know when it opens in the UK. But the film itself is based on Brock Yates' 1991 book, Enzo Ferrari, The Man and the Machine, which I think was name-checked quite recently on an episode of the Intercooler podcast, which is always worth listening to. But basically, I think this is a chance to see Enzo Ferrari in his prime, running the Ferrari company, running the race team, some of the gorgeous cars they produced back in the day. Was he a genius? Was he a ruthless despot? Did he treat his staff terribly? Did he basically manipulate his racing drivers into killing themselves to make him happy? I watched it and kind of went, that was really my reaction to it. Was I just couldn't get past the fact that, hey, that sort of, hey, it's that guy reaction to a very well-known, very distinctive actor in a role that really requires someone to disappear into it, if you see what I mean.
See, the thing I have with Enzo Ferrari is that my vision of him is him at about 70.
That's everyone's vision, is a sort of the old Il Commendatore from Ford versus Ferrari, putting one over Ford.
Yeah. And I think it was a bit like Barry Cryer. He kind of got to the age he was going to be, about 35 or 40, and then just stayed that age until he died. But I do wonder with this, what's the story going to be? What is the focus going to be? Because we've had... I kind of go back to Williams, the documentary, where if there is something about the man that is extraordinary, and I don't mean that necessarily in the sense of a positive, I mean it in the sense of there is something about him that is outside the usual. You know, is he... Well, are they going to tell him as you know, this man who must win at all costs? Is it going to be the, you know, the side of him that saw death with Dino and with his drivers?
I think there's very much going to be the story of his relationship with his son and maybe his death of his son. I don't know how far it goes, actually. That's a good question. One interesting thing that I think Matt pulled out is the fact that somewhere in there is a shot of someone accelerating, much like they do in The Fast and the Furious, where they stamp their foot on the throttle into the carpet. Only in this case, the throttle's in the centre. It's not the right-hand pedal. It's in the centre, and that is apparently a proper nerd, technically correct, that Ferrari did in fact have a centre throttle, with the brake being hopefully on the right and the clutch on the left, because if it was the other way around, that would be really weird.
Did you see as well Marino Franchitti's one of the stunt drivers for it?
I did. I saw a lot on his Insta that he was one of the drivers for it, which kind of, I imagine they will have borrowed some cars from Marino Franchitti's father-in-law, one Nick Mason of the Pink Floyd, and latterly Saucer Full of Secrets. So I imagine that he will have been entrusted to drive some of those. And, you know, it makes sense if you're going to drive racing Ferraris, get people who are familiar with driving old racing Ferraris. You know, Marino's in historic racing quite a lot. He's always a star at the Festival of Speed, the Goodwood Revival. So makes sense. And I, you know what? I kind of like racing drivers being used for stunt driving for films. I love seeing you know, Tanner Faust doing a bunch of work on the Fast movies. It just, like, yeah, these guys are shit hot. Although I imagine Absolutely. Not every racing driver would actually make a good stunt driver. I think you know, Mark Higgins and his second career being the Bond stunt driver, apart from being, you know, a hot hand in any rally car you care to mention, he's the guy that plays James Bond when there's a car chase in a Bond movie. And that's really, really cool. And that's come about quite recently. But you can't imagine, like, Max Verstappen, for example, being asked to do... You know, racing drivers are rubbish at making cars look exciting because they're not... they don't know how to go sideways.
Did you see the featurette around the same time that No Time to Die came out, where they had Mark Higgins, Lance Stroll, and I want to say Seb Vettel, driving the stunt DB5s?
I did see that, yes.
And they just can't slide because their brain is like, stop
they
it sliding,
did it.
Yeah,
stop
they
it was
sliding,
all three
stop
of the
sliding.
Aston drivers, so they had... Lance Stroll, who was, I'm going to be mean here, somewhat predictably rubbish and ham-fisted. And they had Seb Vettel, who started off rubbish but then got better quite quickly. And they had Nico Hülkenberg, who I seem to remember got the hang of it straight away the fastest. But it did show that racing drivers are not normally great at showboating. They have the fast twitch corrections for big slides, but they don't run a car balanced on the throttle because it's just not a thing they ever need to. The cars are slow that way. So I always find it fascinating to see when it is like racing drivers' names you recognize. Like Reese Millen was always one of the guys who was doing stunt driving for the Fast movies and anything involving drifting, because he was a drift champion, much like Tanner Faust. That's how they came to it. And drifting involves going sideways an awful lot, which looks fantastic on film. And so those kind of...
But with precision.
Yes, it's the combo of the two. It's the dramatic and the precise. And generally circuit racers can do one but not the other.
Speaking of circuit racers, shall we go on to what we've been watching? Because I think we've both watched the Sky documentary. What was it called? Because it's not in our notes. Is it called Red 5?
It's actually one of those... It's in that motor film. Williams and Mansell: Red 5.
That's the one.
So this is a documentary on Sky that focuses on both the development of Williams as an F1 team from its start in 1977 and it's sort of progressing on through its heyday in the 80s and with Nigel Mansell and then on to the early 90s. And it parallels that with Nigel Mansell's rise to fame as an F1 driver and his journey from being, you know, a broke guy working in a factory to becoming a Formula One driver, to missing out on world titles on several occasions, you know, crashes, and then his huge success in 92 with one of the most advanced Formula One cars we've ever seen. And then right at the very end, it covers it, like a little bit on from there. And interspersed in all of that is sort of current footage of Nigel getting ready to drive that championship 1992 Williams up the hill at Goodwood. And they do sneak in a little mention of Seb Vettel having bought one and doing a lap or two around Silverstone, which I was waiting for because I knew it happened and I knew that Vettel owned a Red 5 Williams. And I was kind of hoping that they'd make a bit more of that, or they'd get an interview with Vettel, because this is kind of classic documentary talking heads. The people contributing are sort of what you'd expect. So in terms of drivers, you've got Jenson Button, because he's quite tightly affiliated with Williams. He got his start in F1 driving for Williams, and then he's now back in some kind of advisory capacity at Williams. You've got the usual kind of journalist voiceover. You've got people who were there working at Williams at the time. What you don't have is anyone from the Williams family.
That's true. Yeah.
Now, I don't know whether that's because really they weren't involved at the time. You know, Jonathan Williams was doing other things and Claire Williams wasn't involved with the team at this time, so maybe they don't have anything to say or anything to add. There's quite a lot of input from mechanics who worked for the team. There's some really interesting stuff from James Allen, and I'll come back to that in a minute because I think he gets a bad rap. But I found this surprisingly engaging, and I will caveat this to say I am from the Midlands and I have been accused in the past of being what my friend Andy calls a player hater, in that I never liked Nigel Mansell, partly because he's from Birmingham and has that accent, which I grew up with and absolutely hated. Partly because I never liked his blame everybody else but myself kind of whinger reputation, sometimes deserved, sometimes not. But partly because he was brute force over elegance. He was bull in a china shop, wring the neck of it, I can't get past the word brute force. That was his approach to racing. And he was phenomenally fast, but I never really noticed it when I was growing up. And going back and watching this, and there's a load of great footage, as there always is in these documentaries, good archive footage. Some of it you might not have seen before. A lot of it you will have done. You've got you know, you've got the famous shots of Mansell alongside Senna with sparks flying out from underneath both cars as they're dancing like an inch between their front wheels. You've got the brilliant pass of Piquet in 1987 at the British Grand Prix at Silverstone. There's all the stuff you'd expect to be there, but there's loads and loads of stuff of Nigel talking about how difficult it was for him to find the money to go racing and how critical throughout his entire career his relationship with his wife has been to support him as he pursued his dream of being a racing driver. And I found it interesting also, she never pops up at all.
True.
There's nothing from her. There's no, where you might expect in a documentary about a famous racing driver, their partner might be interviewed, especially if there's somebody who is name checked so often. She doesn't make a single appearance. She is literally just like this background bedrock to one man's entire career. And I found that it's kind of encouraging because, you know, racing drivers are generally, you know, famous and can also be, I'm looking for the right way of saying this.
They can be very selfish.
Yeah, they can be very selfish. They can date a lot of women. They can treat a lot of people quite badly. So it was really interesting to see that relationship started before he got famous, continued all the way through, you know, family, everything, his whole career. And is, you know, I think he's talking about celebrating his 45th wedding anniversary or something like that. It's incredible to see. What I found really engaging in this is the sort of parallel fortunes of Mansell and Williams, and his the joy, all the people who work with him, like you put him in the car and you know that is as fast as it will go, which is always an interesting, you hear that sometimes from modern racing teams and, you know, and commentators saying you put Alonso in a car and you know however fast it's going, it's pretty much as fast as that thing will go. You think about some of the shitbox McLarens he drove back in the Honda McLaren days, or, you know, the Aston Martin right now that he is wringing the neck of while his teammate, billionaire Lance Stroll, is sort of tugging around at the back somewhere, absolutely anonymous. And you, Mansell was like that. You put him in the car and whatever he's doing is as fast as that car will go. He never, ever, ever phoned it in. And I found that admirable. I've thoroughly enjoyed this kind of trip back to the past of going, man, there was a time when Williams were the dominant team.
Oh, God, like, yeah.
More dominant than Red Bull are now. Not necessarily in terms of consecutive race wins, but in terms of pace over the rest of the field. Absolutely, that 92 Williams was a monster. And just going back and looking at some of those the 80s races, this was a really good watch. It's on Sky Documentaries, and if you're interested in, you know, 80s and 90s F1, if you like Williams as a team, I'd say it's worth a watch. If you were like me and a bit like, eh, Mansell, then I'd give it a watch. It might not change your opinion, but it will give you more colour behind the man. It's not revolutionary. There's no criticisms of Mansell particularly.
See, that was part of what I found lacking with it, was not criticism as such.
It's clearly made with his involvement and his blessing, and therefore you're not going to get a completely objective look at his career.
No, but I think one thing that I was lacking with it was that sense of why him? What made him so fast? What was it? Because I think I was sort of thinking about it in terms of the Senna documentary. And Senna was kind of mystical. He was charismatic. And he was insanely fast. But it was very much that kind of karting technique. And I mean, I realised that was a slightly different documentary. They didn't really talk about it. But I remember there was some talk, some interview, some feature about the FW14B, the 92 car with the active suspension, where somebody was saying that essentially you had to trust the car.
I think they mention it in here. Yeah. Mansell talks about the fact that you just had to believe that the car would be there for you, and you drove on belief, not feel. And famously, I believe that's why Riccardo Patrese struggled so much. In 1991, he was Mansell's teammate at Williams, and he had a pretty good showing. And 1992, he got absolutely smashed under the Mansell steamroller because Mansell believed that the car would do what the engineer said it would do, and he believed that if he turned the wheel it would stick, even though the car was sending him mixed messages, even though the car might respond slightly later because it's doing that thing with the active aero of keeping a flat platform, so it's not rolling into the corners, which one of the things, I can't remember if it was mentioned here, but, you know, Mansell's incredible upper body strength was often a thing where he just, you know, he had a tiny shirt button for a steering wheel. I couldn't figure out why. Like, why would you have a tiny steering wheel other than maybe it was easy for him to fit in the car? But, you know, his ability and his belief and his faith in his mechanics and his team to build him a car, and he would reward that faith by going out and absolutely blitzing it. And you can't think of a car better suited for somebody. I don't want to say it with a lack of imagination, but someone who is so willing to back themselves and their own talent that they will just turn into a corner with just the sheer belief that the car will go round it.
You know, despite the messages they're getting off. The one that reminds me of is Vettel in the blown diffuser Red Bulls, where there's that bit where an engineer says to you, right, when you turn into the corner, floor the throttle, like way earlier than you think, and it will stick. You know, hold the throttle open while you're on the brakes, and just go, okay.
Yeah,
I mean, wasn't that the thing with Lauda as well, where they had the gauge and you had to basically keep the revs up or the throttle up in the... Was it the fan car? One of the...
That'd be a Brabham.
Ground effect Ferraris, where it's just like, as long as this dial is in this bit of the... You know, the needle's pointing this bit of the dial, you've got downforce, so drive accordingly. And he's went, okay.
Yeah, it's adapting yourself to the machinery that you're given is one of the traits of the very, very greats. And interestingly, Vettel was never able to demonstrate it anywhere else other than in those blown diffuser Red Bulls. He was never able to demonstrate the ultimate adaptability that, say, a Hamilton has, a Verstappen has.
Or a Schumacher.
Or a Senna. Or a Mansell, for that matter. And I think that's very interesting. But yeah, you're right. It's you know, DC and Hakkinen being given a third pedal in the McLarens in 1997, 1998, and being told, you know, pressing this pedal will break the rear wheels as well as the fronts.
I do have to say with this, there were three things actually that stuck out to me. Opening it with Mansell and Senna at Monaco felt like a misstep. It felt like they had to put that in somewhere and they'd run out of places. Karun Chandhok, I think, is a brilliant pundit.
Oh yeah, he's fantastic in this. I should have mentioned him earlier on.
The depth of knowledge he's got, but he's got proper enthusiasm. He sounds excited.
His love for the sport comes through, but his knowledge of it and his absolute recollection of that, he's exceptional. And he's said that he's been doing this since he was a kid, more or less, this kind punditry commentating. He used it to pay his racing way. And it, when you hear that, you go, oh, so that's why you're so polished and,
exactly.
and so brilliant. And he is really, really good in this.
And the other thing is that I think I only heard two instances of Murray Walker's commentary being used, which if this had been 10 years ago, it would have been wall-to-wall Murray, because I think Mansell Mania and Murray Walker kind of went together. But I think we're now at a point in history where there is now... That's now starting to kind of recede and fade. And I don't think that they missed it until you notice it's not there.
Well, until you get a bit of Murray Walker... I forget which race it is. There's a chunk of it where everything goes wrong.
When his tyre blows at Adelaide and you get Murray Walker, and look at that! Yeah. Look at that!
It's so good. And to be fair, that clip is astonishing. And I'm really glad that they focus in on Mansell's car control being, you know, on full display there, because it is every correction. I think it's Jensen that points it out, that every correction is absolutely spot on. And with almost any other driver, that car would have been in the wall. What is interesting, and I've heard that comment about his car control being mentioned long in the past, that you know, his rescuing of that car with no rear tire is super heroic. But what hadn't been mentioned that I hadn't thought about was, what if he hadn't saved it? What if it just nosed itself into the barriers? That would have been an almost immediate red flag, because you couldn't clear it away, which would have meant he would have won the title.
Yeah.
Which is a really fascinating thought I'd never, never considered before. So there's some good stuff in this documentary. I'd highly recommend watching it if you've got Sky and you want to while away, I guess, what is it, an hour and
a quarter? It's quite long.
It's over an
with
hour.
Adverts.
And if you watch it online, you don't have to have the adverts.
Interesting. Shall we whistle through what else we've been watching?
Yeah, I'll whistle through very, very quickly. So other than that aforementioned Williams and Mansell documentary, I've been watching like the usual stuff on YouTube. BS for Build is back building boats instead of cars. He has a 30-year-old Italian boat that they blew up the diesel engines in. And so in that classic YouTuber way, went, you know what this needs? Two whacking great Texas Speed V8s. So he's
of course
switched it from being a diesel-powered boat that doesn't go very fast to being two petrol-powered whacking great Texas Speed V8s that are troublesome but do seem to make the thing go faster. I've just been enjoying it because it's different from the normal stuff, and their troubleshooting approach is quite fun to watch, seeing how people solve problems. Really enjoyed watching Sam Crack, who I don't know if you've ever mentioned on this channel. He's a sort of an old school automotive YouTuber, does a lot of the insurance write off rebuilds and so on. And he's had a Ferrari 430 that had suffered fire damage. And there's a fun video of him and the UK's Rattarossa fixing said fire damaged F430. And between that and Matt Armstrong rebuilding an F430, I quite want an F430 now. but yes, watching that being rebuilt and quite interestingly seeing how back to basics they go. You go, here's a bit of burnt out wiring loom. We're not even going to bother trying to fix it. We're just going to replace it all together. Seeing them diagnose what's wrong with it, what's right with it, how the fire affected some components and managed to magically miss damaging lots of the car. Seeing them, you know, weld in a new rear quarter panel. I really love that kind of back to basics YouTubing automotive content. So I really love that one. And then they mentioned, this has been, I texted you and Matt about this. I then heard them mention a YouTuber called Whistling Diesel, who is not something that I watch. This is an American who buys cars and then does fucking stupid stuff in them until they break and then wears a hat. And this is a guy who bought an F8 or was it even...
It's an F8 Tributo, I think.
He bought an F8 Tributo and he's running it flat out in a cornfield. And understandably, when you drive a Ferrari off-road in a cornfield, bits of corn get stuck next to hot things like exhausts and corn is dry and it catches fire. So this godforsaken prick is suddenly really surprised when this dry stuff that's clogged up all in his wheels, all on the brakes and next to his very hot exhaust, and the car catches fire. And then they just pour bits of Red Bull on it and water, and they're absolutely mortified when, oh my God, do you think it was a really good idea to drive a performance supercar around a cornfield? Then it catches fire and the cornfield catches fire because that's what cornfields do. And then they panic and, you know, they chuck a few more bottles of water on it, and then they realise that their filming van is catching fire, that they better call the fire brigade. I've never seen such a bunch of absolute pricks being absolute pricks. And I just couldn't watch any more of it. And the guy's all like, oh my God, I can't believe it. And I just can't help but look and go, you made your bed, mate. Now you've got to live in it. What an absolute tool. And I know his whole shtick is I'm going to take a car and put it on square wheels and drive it around, or I'm going to take this thing and do things you're not meant to do, like drift it in dirt. That's fine, but I presume they had permission to race on that field. Maybe not. But certainly, how can you not have seen this coming? Mm. And his sort of rank surprise of course I'm not insured. No one will insure me because I break stuff. You know, it's not my thing. So, yeah, I watched a bit of that and then got very, very, very cross and turned it off.
Fair enough.
How about you?
So I'm going to recommend another podcast, which we don't do nearly enough here, but this one kind of caught my attention. So for those who aren't aware, there's a long, long-running radio series in the UK called Desert Island Discs, which some of this podcast format may have been stolen from. And essentially, it's a celebrity interview where they say, right, you're on a desert island, what 8 records are you going to take? What book? What luxury? But in the process of doing so, they talk about their life and their upbringing and all this sort of thing. And this is, you know, this is as mainstream as it gets. This is BBC Radio in the UK. This is not specialist press in any way, shape or form. And they had on it Toto Wolff, who has a life that I never knew about. He grew up in not great circumstances. You know, he's had to work really hard for what he's got. He damn near killed himself at the Nürburgring at the 24 Hours. He's a great speaker. He's led a life that is interesting and textured and doesn't really get enough attention, I think. And I think he's probably one of these people as well that doesn't dwell on it. I think it's easy to look at him now and go, oh, you're successful, you're an investor, you're, you know, F1 team boss and owner. And then actually when you start going back through his history, you're like, wow, you've really worked for it, you've really earned it. And he just has a very good sense of being able to talk eloquently about what he does, about what he has done, the way he thinks about things. it's not that long. It's like half an hour, and it's a really, really interesting watch. I hope it's available outside the UK. We'll put a link to that, of course, in the show notes with everything else. I also got stuck watching a lot of Daily Driven Exotics, DDE, who... There is somebody in that organisation who's churning out a half-hour video every single day of something. I get slightly frustrated with them because the videos are a bit baggy, but I think they kind of go for watch time and frequency over
quality,
concise editing.
Yeah.
But they also do this thing where they will have a slightly clickbaity title, which actually relates to one sentence in a half-hour video. But
all YouTubers do that.
They have to.
Yeah,
it's the game.
You've got to play the game, I'm sure. Or maybe it was Tavares on the Smoking Tire podcast quite recently, talking about how, you know, thumbnails and titles and so on can make or break a video, and how there's stuff out there that would be getting loads more views if it had a better thumbnail or a better title. And obviously we've seen YouTubers changing titles to try and bring in more attention. But yeah, I've watched a few Daily Driven Exotics. I saw some stuff where they were doing... maybe they were on with Matt Armstrong doing the Gumball. I've seen some stuff with them and Mr. JWW, somebody else who I don't always like watching.
So they're doing a series at the moment where they are basically rebuilding an F12 into a drift car for SEMA. And because they are producing half an hour of content every day, you're essentially seeing this F12 engine just stripped down over half an hour. They'll then have the next episode where they take it to a machine shop, and you get to see around this machine shop, and these two very knowledgeable people talk about how to refurbish an engine. And it's a really interesting series at the moment, but it's half an hour every single day. And once the algorithm goes, oh, you must really like this, you then get more and more and more of it. So definitely worth a dip in. I think if you like the exotics bit, you probably tune out of some videos. If you like the engineering side, you probably tune out some of the other videos. But there's plenty there, and I'd say it's definitely a well-produced, kind of entertaining series. Also, speaking of things that are entertaining, Chris Harris driving the Tuttle 911K. I commented after I saw it. You remember when Chris took the then new GT3 RS 3.8, the 997, to France to drive with? Not, I was going to say Didier Auriol. It wasn't Didier Auriol.
No,
you're
thinking of François Delacour.
François Delacour. And Chris made that face when he was kind of being driven.
Yeah.
Seeing a rally driver drive a car with a hydraulic handbrake on a tight circuit like Blyton, where it's basically hard on the brakes, throw it in, deal with it on the way through. And Chris is looking a little bit like, I trust you and I know what you're doing, but oh my God.
Which is face we all wear if we have a passenger lap with anyone who's handy. So it's really interesting seeing, you know, who is someone who is effectively a professional driver have that same face when they're being driven by somebody. Now, if you go and search the YouTubes, you'll see plenty of videos of Richard Tuttle driving old 911s, particularly on snow. But this is a man who is an exceptional rally driver who could have been set for a completely different career path had things turned out differently, who could have been a professional WRC driver. And he's got skills. And seeing this 911 being thrown around, this particularly less than 890 kilos?
It's something like that, yeah.
And that's full of fluids, 890 kilos. And it's got 400 horsepower?
I must say, you know what? If I was going to buy a Tuttle 911 or a Singer or anything like that, perhaps without the gold paint and the hydraulic handbrake, but the idea of small, lightweight, pokey, essentially a kind of rally car in lightweight carbon fibre clothing is so appealing to me.
I wonder how well it will sell, because people buy Singers because of the exquisite craftsmanship and what it says about them and their wallet. Mm. I don't know that they buy Singers to drive. They buy it for, like, the way you buy
A suit.
Yeah, or a suit or a Ricard Mille watch. you're not buying it to tell the time. You're buying it to show how much money you've got and the kind of tastes you have. And I feel like people buy Singers for the same reason. And I feel like those kinds of people won't buy a Turtle 911. The people who buy this are going to be people like Chris Harris, potentially. Not saying that he's getting one, but, you know, people who are well off, but care more about driving than they do about looking cool.
So I think that you are half right. I think you're right that people will go to Tuttle because they want a car to drive and they want that kind of tame rally car experience rather than something as polished as a Singer. I think that Tuttle have definitely moved in previous years to that kind of Singer model where you go, where it's not just about the car. I think that with anything that is luxury like that, there is an amount of you get brought in, you get sat down, you get told, you know, you can have whatever you want. It's like, what metal would you like the screws plated with? You know, what sort of glass would you like the windows made out of? What sort of, you know, if you want all the seats trimmed in, you know, whale foreskin, then of course, sir, that's not a problem at all. And I think the thing with Tuttle is that they take a similar approach where you can basically sit down with them and a clean sheet of paper and you're not buying a model. You could probably go in there and say, okay, I'd like the carbon fiber panels of the K, but I'd like the four-wheel drive system out of a 964. I'd like the engine out of a 996 turbo. And they would, you know, bolt them all together. And if your thing is, well, I'd like the interior trimmed like this and I don't care about the engine, I'm sure they would do that for you as well.
Yeah, I get that. I think this is very specifically the brainchild of Richard Tuttle himself, and I'm assuming it's going to sell pretty well given the numbers. I'd love to know how it does. But the film's very interesting for seeing Chris Harris get driven by somebody else who is equally as skilled in hooning around a tight circuit and you hit the faces he makes after driving it on the road where it renders him not quite speechless, but searching for the right set of words to describe a car. And you don't see that very often with these journalists. And I think that shows what kind of a savage beast it is. And that's very interesting because, like I say, you don't see this with the latest GT3 or the latest Ferrari. Mm. They don't tend to leave seasoned old hands completely speechless. That's usually the preserve of full house race cars.
Yes. Yes. Speaking of full house race cars, should we go into our film review?
We should do, because it's been 48 minutes so far, and we need to keep this to a tight 45.
For 45.
So unfortunately, we're already 5 minutes over, but that's okay, because Chris is going to whiz through his review of the new Hollywood movie, Gran Turismo.
Before we get into the film, what are you drinking tonight?
Ah, well, in keeping with the motorsport,
sit back and enjoy
theme,
it.
The motorsport theme, I'm drinking Jenson Button's Coach Built Whiskey, which is a blended Scotch whiskey from... I don't think it's actually Jenson Button, but I think he had a hand in blending it. But it is delicious. It is very, very well priced. And I'm enjoying a spot of that today.
It is a good daily drinker.
It is. It's like 45 quid. And it's an excellent, excellent blended Scotch whiskey. And I'm normally quite sniffy and like a single malt. So this is really good. And it's got the motorsport connection. So I figured that was appropriate. How about you?
True. I have got a glass of the Ardbeg Barbecue. Which is
great
a mix.
Name.
It is. Well, it's a mix of, I think, ex-bourbon, ex-sherry casks, and one that might have been smoked with something barbecue-y, but they don't want to say in case they piss off the Scotch Whiskey Association. But it's absolutely gorgeous. It's limited release. It's like 75 quid, and it's 50-odd% and well worth every penny. So, now that I'm suitably lubricated, which I have to be to talk about Gran Turismo, I'm going to start this review with a couple of caveats. I'm going to go through it twice, so once for the film, once for the car content. And when I talk through it, this film is based on real events, and based on is doing a lot of heavy lifting. There are some things that are changed for plot reasons, for narrative reasons, which I have no issue with whatsoever. I'm not going to be going through going, well, I think you'll find actually that, you know, that year the GTR did whatever. There are a couple of things that I caught early on where there's a Lego model that is on Jan Mardenborough's shelf, which hadn't come out when the film was made. There's the wrong year GTRs used in some of the GT Academy things. There are bigger fish than that to fry. I will get to those. So Gran Turismo is the based on real events story of Jan Mardenborough, who went from being a gamer to ultimately racing for Nissan, and still races for Nissan, I believe. And it follows his progress from wannabe gamer through the GT Academy process, which, if you are the age that I am, was actually a televised series with Johnny Herbert, I think, possibly Eddie Irvine.
God. Man, they got through despite having Eddie Irvine in there.
And then it goes through... so then Jan won a drive at the 24 Hours of Dubai. He had to do some racing in order to get his appropriate licenses. And basically he got a crash course, a boot camp in racing from Nissan through RGN Motorsport, who later went on to run British GT with Jenson Button. If you want to know the real story, Josh Revel has just done a great, genuinely great sort of documentary that sort of goes through week by week, not week by week, but kind of year by year through his career. Jan raced in single seaters, he's raced in GTs, he's raced at Le Mans in some good things and some less good things.
He's done a lot of work in, he did Super GT in Japan.
A lot of racing in Japan.
With Nissan, which I really enjoyed watching. I watched him racing when Jenson Button had retired from F1 and went off to do Super GT in Japan, and thoroughly enjoyed seeing, because he had that time at Le Mans and then sort of faded away from European racing. It was really cool to go, oh, it's Jan Mardenborough.
So the film itself focuses a lot on Jan as this kind of wannabe racer who spends all of his time racing in Gran Turismo. He then gets the opportunity to race in, do the GT Academy series. And in order to enter that, you had to enter online races. You had to win your qualifiers online. The top, I think, 20 went through to a regional final, and then there was a world final. There's a kind of a conflict between him and his dad. His dad's like, you should get a proper job. Jan's like, no, but I want to be a racer. So, well, you need something to fall back on. No, I'm going to go off and be a racing car driver. People like you aren't racing car drivers. Jerry Halliwell Horner, as I think she's credited, plays Jan's mum, whose most famous line is going to be, these lentils are nice. But
which is not convincing me. I don't like lentils.
To be fair, she plays her limited role well, but the... It was almost like Adam Driver, like saying with Enzo, you kind of go, hang on, isn't that Jerry Halliwell?
I think that is a problem with extraordinarily famous people like Jerry Halliwell Horner.
Yes.
I have heard that she is not the worst thing about the movie by any stretch.
No, no, no.
And
absolutely
that's,
not.
You know, she's got a range and she appears to be playing to it here, and
yep,
that's fine.
Yep. So then once Jan, spoiler alert, I'm assuming that you know the rough story of Jan Mardenborough if you listen to a podcast as nerdy as ours. But he goes on, he wins GT Academy, and he then gets paired in the film with David Harbour's character, who is this
Don't tell me, grizzled old mechanic brought out of retirement to help whip these newcomers into shape.
Very nearly. There was one bit of his character you missed.
I don't know, go on.
He used to be a racing driver and gave up on his dream.
Is there a shot of him like restoring some old busted up race car in a barn that is lit at sunset? The full Days of Thunder.
Not quite.
They missed a trick there. They should have just been like shameless at lifting this.
So he basically takes Jan under his wing. He becomes a kind of a second father figure to him. And they go up against, in the world of GT racing, they go up against, I can't remember the character's name, but he is essentially Bo Brandenburg.
MXT, bad guy.
Yeah, he's tall, blonde, possibly German. His Lamborghini race car is essentially black and gold with Moët Chandon sponsorship on it. And it's kind of like, how can we make this... These people, obviously the baddies. How about we make the car black with gold accents? That will do. And then over the course of the event, you basically follow Jan through his GT career. So he goes from there, he goes to racing at the Nürburgring, where... Sadly, truly, true to life, he has suffered a big crash, ended up killing a spectator at Flugplatz in the GTR. And they then sort of follow his career through to Le Mans. I was led to believe going into this, and maybe this was my preconception, that this was going to be Gran Turismo on the big screen. So it was going to be kind of bridging the gap between the game and real life. And there's a few occasions where they do it. There's a few occasions where you see camera angles from the game. You see menus from the game. You hear sound effects from the game. But the idea, and I think there's a shot in the trailer where Jan's on a sim rig that in his mind it then becomes a racing car. There's a scene early on where he's out driving with his mates and he kind of, it's like he sees the world through a game overlay, but they never really stick with it. It kind of comes in flashes, but it never quite feels like you're fully into that Gran Turismo world. It's like, that's your access, but then it's actually about Jan. It's not about Gran Turismo. David Harbour really does play a kind of a father figure. So you've got this idea that Jan, he doesn't want to follow his dad because his dad was a professional footballer who then gave up so that he could then get a proper job. Jan doesn't want that. So he kind of rejects his father, finds another father figure in David Harbour, who is really good as the grizzled, I don't give a shit, I'm only here because I'm being paid to coach, not as an actor, but as a coach. And the way that their relationship plays out is really nice. The way that Jan's relationship with his dad kind of plays out is really nice. Both of them feel a bit... Jan's relationship with his dad feels particularly obvious and a bit forced. I texted you after I saw it and said you could do a drinking game with Chekhov's gun. So for those of you who don't know, Chekhov's gun is this screenwriting trope that if somebody's holding a gun in Act One, it will go off in Act Three.
See, this
and
in
there's lots of
Top Gun Maverick had this where they showed you, oh, there's even some F-14 where they show you some old F-14s.
Yes,
in the start, and then you just know that they're going to end up flying one of those at the end of the movie.
Exactly.
Sorry,
exactly.
Spoilers for Top Gun Maverick if you haven't seen it, but yeah.
And there's stuff like that where there'll be some bit of advice that's given in the first act that then, you know, echoes literally in the audio.
This is basically their equivalent of use the force, Luke.
Oh, it really is. It really is. There's
Turn into the skid, Jan.
Sometimes you'll be going so fast turning left, you'll start turning right. The Kermode, Mark Kermode review of this was like, there is no subtext, there is just text. You know, nothing is left unsaid.
Well, you remember, we've talked, if you can go back and listen to previous episodes of the podcast, you'll have heard us talking about the trailer, which has been fairly heavily screened in front of lots of things. And I think all of my comments were, this is going to be shit. Like you can tell that the text is yelling at you from the screen in the trailer, and I think the whole movie, by all accounts, is just like that.
So, right. So here's the thing: there is, and I haven't got onto the car stuff yet because that we need to talk about that in depth. But the plot, the annoying thing is that this isn't. But it's just, it lacks finesse. It lacks a bit of depth. It lacks a bit of sparkle in the story and in the telling. It opens with, what, 5-10 minute, basically promo for Gran Turismo about how awesome it is. The product placement through it is unbelievable. Like, I pick up on, you know, I watch James Bond going, oh, well, Macallan, Omega, you know, Aston Martin. I saw Sony.
Heineken.
But with this, it is just, I mean, it's a film made by Sony about a flagship Sony product that they just go, you know, they spend all this time telling you how great Gran Turismo is, how it's not just a racing game, it's a simulation. Then you go and see Nissan, and you've got Orlando Bloom playing Darren Cox, and all that, and he goes into the Nissan office where every single screen behind the reception desk says Nissan. He then goes into a boardroom where there's Nissan on every wall. You know, they're then in the GT Academy, which, fair, you know, was sponsored by Nissan, so everybody's got Nissan. They then go to the pub, and for no reason whatsoever, there's a laptop open on the pub table with a Nissan wallpaper on it. And then there's a thing about music in it. And one character has a Sony Walkman, a big grey and yellow 90s waterproof cassette Walkman. And it's, you know, it just says Sony on it in big letters. The film starts off with Jan receiving a Fanatec steering wheel, which he's saved up from his rubbish job, and he's bought this Fanatec steering wheel. And you know it's a Fanatec steering wheel because he says it's a Fanatec steering wheel. His mate comes around and goes, how's that new Fanatec steering wheel? Oh, what, this Fanatec steering wheel? It's really, really good.
Did you know who makes it?
Yes. And the thing is that he did use a Fanatec steering wheel. Was the one that he was using in the film the one that he was using in real life? No, that would be far too accurate. Which brings me on to my next... Actually, no, before I get on to my problems with the film, the other thing is the editing. Now, I was looking forward to this because Mauro Callo was driving his GTR, appropriately, doing some of the camera work for it. And they was like, we're going to put you into the game. And they edit it so fast that you cannot follow or enjoy any of the shots. It's just like snap, 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 snap. And then it goes swirly drone because it's 2023 rather, and everything's now swirly drones. And I was just like, they hang on these swirly drone shots. And I was like, no, I want to go back. I want to go back to the car stuff. I want to see car to car right in there. And then I was watching the behind-the-scenes footage, and it's not a swirly drone. It's, what's his name? Peter North.
It's a helicopter.
Astonishing pilot.
Peter North? Is that not some old porn star?
I'll take your word for it.
Kids don't Google that.
But he's doing these amazing bits of camera... Fred North. He's doing these amazing bits of camera work that
definitely
make it look
don't
like...
Definitely don't Google Peter North.
Don't Google Peter North. He's doing these great bits of flying and camera work that make it look like a sort of $1,000 DJI drone. And it's...
Which is a waste of great helicopter work. But I think that's what
they're being...
waste
of so much.
Because you can't fly a cinema-level camera on a regular drone, or probably not even on a... on an octocopter.
You can now. There's the Fuji F, not Fuji, the Sony FX3 is like Netflix rated and will hang off the bottom of a drone. But
Netflix
they had
rated
a helicopter.
That's not Netflix rated is not a recommendation.
Anyway, so there's all of the product placement is horrendous. The script is it's just ordinary. If you know, you can go and watch it and you will have a nice enough time. Unless you know about cars. So during the GT Academy trials, I spot that there's a GTR that has the wrong steering wheel boss. So one of the major midlife refreshes.
And here we go. We're now deep in the weeds of this.
Wait.
I think you'll find that GTR does not have that steering boss in 1992.
Let me be clear here. So this is... So I was kind of like, okay, you know, these things happen, production mistake, whatever, that's fine. And they're driving these GTRs, and they get to the race, and they see Jan's nemesis, who's driving a GT3 Lamborghini Huracan. And I was like, hang on, this is supposed to be like 2013? And they're just like, no, we don't care about that. So in order to show just how wealthy this man is, him and his entourage get into the new four-door Koenigsegg right in front of Jan and David Harbour.
I was going to ask with this, though, did they actually commit to saying, you know, this happened 10 years ago? Or did they just go, look, this is just a story based on truth, but we're not going to bother trying to do it in period? Because that's why I asked the question is, are they actually, do they bother saying, you know, this was 2013? Do they come up on a big title card or anything? Or do they just go, look, this is a story and we're setting it in present day because it's a lot easier to do?
So I was trying to think, and I would be very, very interested to see if there was something that tied it to a specific time. Because all of the racing sequences are modern day GT3 cars, including what they called a Ford GT3. And even things like the Nürburgring, so that they race at the Nürburgring, and, you know, as you know, they have big fields, and there's 10 cars racing in one pack. And I kind of think, okay, again, you haven't got the budget necessarily to fill the grid with like 100 cars, so maybe you're just like focusing on that snapshot of the race. But then once Jan, and again, you're right, I mean, maybe I am bringing stuff to this, but, you know, I know that that crash happened in sort of 2015 or whatever it was. And when Jan and David Harbour's character, his name I still can't remember, it's that memorable, they go and survey the scene to try and help Jan get over this trauma in a 992 GT3 RS, which they then drive the rest of the lap on the Nordschleife in beautiful golden hour light with beautiful cinematography. But it's just like, what's this got to do with anything? Then they get to Le Mans, which is, they're all in LMP3 cars for some reason. One, LMP3 cars don't take part in the 24 Hours of Le Mans. Two, that's not what they were driving. Three, GT drivers don't suddenly go, hang on, do you fancy driving LMP cars this weekend? Yeah. And there's a couple of crashes in it that are driven level events.
Does someone end up upside down in a lake?
There are...
Is it Pedro de la Rosa?
There are a couple that are stupid, and they are just... they happen,
sorry,
and you just go...
Sorry, I just have to stop. And if this were a video podcast right now, I would be showing you a picture of Pedro de la Rosa, where he's just sat there going, bollocks, I have fallen into a river. Which is...
Deep sniff petrol cut.
The most funny thing I have ever seen, ever. Anyway, I'm very sorry I've spoilt your rant about how terrible this is to bring Pedro de la Rosa falling into a river at the 2002 US Grand Prix.
There is never a bad time to bring up Pedro de la Rosa falling into a river. Wasn't that a series where he just travelled around Europe rivers?
Around the world with Pedro de la Rosa, yes.
It's just... There are just so many things where you think that could have been so good, that could have been so interesting. And there's stuff in there that doesn't make sense, but because they've kind of gone based on real events, there's a clip package over the credits where they went, that thing you think that we were being silly about, no, that actually happened. No, he really did do this. No, that really did happen. And it's almost like the end of Air, the Michael Jordan shoe story.
Where you get to see the real characters, where you see the real people, and you get that kind of, oh, so they cast, it does look kind of like that, and you get to see, sometimes I really enjoy that because you get to see what the real person looks like, and you get that joy of going, yeah, they cast pretty close to that, or that, you know, they really, the production team really made this car look dead right, just right, or they made the build English right, just right.
So I did reach out on Instagram see if anybody had questions about Gran Turismo before we recorded, and do follow us on Instagram because we're going to be doing more stuff there now that X is slowly collapsing into a hellscape. Matt Lange, who we mentioned earlier, did ask if pressing the throttle pressed harder to go faster. I have to say, in that respect, it's actually not bad. I did notice that the actor who plays Jan does this thing where every time he's like pulling away, he like throws his head back into the headrest, which is obviously a bit of overacting. And once you notice it, you can't stop.
I read a really interesting interview. Or maybe it was not an interview, but maybe it was a piece on Gran Turismo where they described that he did not like being in the cars at all because he's quite tall, and racing drivers tend to not be tall, and to fit him into the car was quite a challenge, and so it was very uncomfortable,
yeah,
and he just
that.
Didn't enjoy it. There's some interesting stuff out there on the web about this movie, about the making of. One of the things I read quite recently was the director, Neil Blomkamp, who you'll know for District 9 and Elysium and maybe Chappie if you've seen it, and the aborted Aliens reboot sort of sequel prequel thing that he was involved in. He's effectively a gun for hire on this. I think he was contacted by the studio and said, would you like to direct this? And he was like, well, if this helps me get something that I want made in the future, then yes, I'll do it.
That would make a lot of sense.
The interview I read was basically structuring it in such a way to say he's sort of semi-distancing himself from this movie by saying, look, I didn't write it. I wasn't involved in, you know, the kind of the genesis of this movie, the gestation of it. I'm a hired gun. I was brought on to bring it to life on the screen, and I've done that. It was very much that kind of tone, which is interesting. I don't know whether or not he's towed the party line in official interviews and so on, but I get the impression that this was a paying gig when he needed one, because he's not really had much in the way of films coming out recently. And I think he very much wants to do the kind of stories he wants to tell, and this is maybe a means to get that made. One of the other things I wanted to bring up was this movie, it was released earlier over here, so we've had this out for 2 weeks now, 3 weeks. I think it's only been out for a week in the States, maybe two. And so far, worldwide, this film has made $80 million.
Wow. That's not much, because I think the budget's 200.
So, and this has been out, it's been in release for 11 days, just over a week. And it's made in the US $30 million and international 50 or so.
Now, one thing I do think about that, and I know that we kind of discussed this. So when you watch the film, one of the big things for me that I just couldn't get around was that almost every circuit looks like Hungaroring, because a huge swathe of it was shot at the Hungaroring. So if you drive the Hungaroring backwards, that's apparently Silverstone. The last two corners, if you CGI them onto the straight at Le Mans, that then becomes Le Mans, and it doesn't. And I was like, they shot the Nürburgring stuff on the Nordschleife, because
you can't really do
that in CG. I was like, well, why didn't they just hire Silverstone? Why didn't they hire these different circuits? And watching the very end of the credits, because I do things like that. Speaking of which, one of the precision drivers, just going back to what we were saying before, is a guy called Ollie Milroy, who, I don't know if you know, I follow him on Twitter. He runs a travel agent, drives GT3 cars very, very quickly, and apparently does a bit of stunt driving on the side. But I was watching, got right down to the end of the credits, and every single country they visit has their banner for, like, thank you to the Hungarian tax film unit tax scheme, whatever.
All films do this now. I think all major films are looking for a way of filming in places that have advantageous tax breaks.
Oh, God. Yeah, but then you've got, so they have it for Hungary, they have it for France, they have it for Germany. I'm not sure if they shot in Japan, but Nissan, if Nissan did not put a pot of cash into this, I will be hugely surprised. if, I mean, Sony, their marketing department, again, if they didn't put a pot of money into this as a marketing exercise, I will be hugely surprised. I think it will go down a bit like Rush, in that I think it will kind of, this won't become a cult film. I think once it hits streaming services, it will find an audience. I don't think people, I think the GT fans have probably gone out and watched it. And that's kind of it. It hasn't crossed over into the
It's not a mainstream movie. No, it's not crossed over in a way that
Which it could be. I think if they've done it differently, you're right.
It could be a great sports movie or a good sports movie. It hasn't crossed over. Now, something like Ford versus Ferrari or Le Mans 66, depending on your country, that didn't have a huge box office return. I think 200-ish million, but it had a much smaller budget, which meant it made its money back. And that did cross over to the mainstream to a certain extent, because it's a kind of Sunday afternoon dad's movie.
And
this, without, I know that sounds terrible, but you know, this could take that storytelling. This should have been basically Days of Thunder for the console generation.
Oh God, yeah, absolutely.
You
know,
that, you could have just gone, well, why don't we just do that? Just beat for beat, make Days of Thunder, but substitute in, you know, Jan Mardenborough for Cole Trickle. Cole Trickle. Yeah. And so on and so on. You know, the trailers for this, I will watch it when it comes to streaming. Chris took the fall on this one and went to see it in the cinema and paid his own money. And I will watch it when it comes to streaming, and I will pay money or something to buy it on a Blu-ray format to watch extras and so on. I like Neil Blomkamp as a director, and I have owned every single Gran Turismo game there is, including the current Gran Turismo 7. It's a good job they didn't try and make it too much like the game, because the menus in all of these Gran Turismo things are basically impenetrable. So it would have been more realistic if the guy wandered into a cafe and looked at the owner saying, hey, do you want me to go and race for some cars? And the guy went, yes, I'd like you to go and collect all of these super rare Japanese K cars and a Nissan Silvia.
Go and race those for several days first.
Then come back and I will give you a present. And that present will be another weirdo Japanese K car.
One thing that I will just touch on as well, because we did have a question from Jake Sanson on Instagram as well, who said, why is Jan Mardenborough the only real driver in the film? And I think this is a really interesting question, because
they forgot about Lucas Ordóñez.
Well, it's more than that. So every encounter basically with other drivers, there is the thing, and again, this is one of the points that I'm willing to overlook for sort of plot reasons, is that the film basically has these two things of Jan Mardenborough, who, when he wins a race, he can only win a race by like a hundredth of a second. There's no race that he goes and wins by like a lap. Every single race he has to win, he wins by like a fraction. He is the only person in this who is referenced by his real name. So Darren Cox, there's this kind of parallel where Darren Cox is trying to get GT Academy off the ground, and Jan Mardenborough is working on his sim racing. Except Darren Cox, who is an executive producer on the film, as is Jan, isn't called Darren Cox. His name is, you know, Jeff Jefferson or something.
Jeff Bloom.
Yes.
Jeff Orlando Bloom. I don't know. I can see maybe why some people might not want to be... want to see people portraying them using their real name. Like, honestly, they could have done this without naming the lead guy Jan Mardenborough. It's not a Hollywood leading man type role name, is it?
No. But the thing is, you've got... So, you know, Jan Mardenborough, it wasn't the first GT Academy winner. Like you say, it was Lucas Ordóñez. And he's in the film, except he's not called Lucas Ordóñez. He's, you know, Steve Stevenson or whatever it is.
You know who they should have called? They should have been like Jimmy Bly, rookie sensation. They could have gone full driven on this, but they should have taken the initials like they did want. Because Jimmy Bly is basically an allegory for Jenson Button in Driven. So they should have just got JM and gone Juan Manuel Fangio. Or so, I'm being very silly.
One thing that I did see that kind of went, was the There's one where, where they've got the world finals and they've got all of these actors, most of whom mean nothing to me. There was one where I went, hang on, isn't that Amelia Hartford? And she's one of the other GT Academy entrants for no apparent reason, apart from, I mean, she's very good at what she does.
Well,
and it's
there
just
you go.
Like, huh, weird.
So would you say this is worth going to the cinema and seeing?
No. No.
Right. Would you say this is worth watching on an streaming service that you already have and therefore not paying for anything?
To be honest, if Sony are not giving this away in 6 months' time, I think they are missing a trick. I think you're right. What I'm going to be looking forward to with this is the extras, the commentary, the, you know, the VFX shots, the stuff that's ended up on the cutting room floor. I think if you are a fan of endurance racing, I think that you will get something from it. I think if you try and look for something that isn't there, you're going to be disappointed. And I think that was probably what I ended up doing, was that this is very much a surface level film.
Yeah.
And there are some good moments in it. There is some good driving work in it. There are some good acting moments in it. But you have to kind of cherry pick what comes along. If you get a chance to watch it, let us know what you think. I would not be making a trip out to the cinema again specifically to watch this.
Cool. All right. Well, there you go. That's Gran Turismo. Sort of a recommendation if you are super into this kind of thing, but otherwise, I would wait for rental. Kids, ask your parents what that means.
Be kind of rewind.
Let's move on swiftly because we've now done an hour and 24. We're super going for it here. Let's very quickly check in and see what Henry Catchpole has been doing. We should briefly mention that this small pokey podcast has actually met Henry Catchpole now.
We
have this pictorial evidence. If you go on to, is it on our Instagram or is it just on yours?
I think it's, I will put it on our Instagram. Two very tall men and one who could
very
easily
short
fit us under, who could fit under the seat in front.
Chris and I went to the recent live recording of the Intercooler podcast, an excellent podcast that you should subscribe to, which was at Harry's Car Barn somewhere near Stratford-upon-Avon. And they had special guest Henry Catchpole. And so at the end, before everyone filed off, I thought it was worth us going and introducing ourselves to Henry and saying, hi, what have you been up to? Because we're sad like that. And Henry was very gracious with his time and allowed a photograph to be taken to prove that we all did exist in the same place, and was extraordinarily generous with his time. So we want to say thank you to Henry. And what has he been up to, Chris?
Other than podcasting and indulging suffering in films on the internet. he's had a good run of films up on Haggerty recently. He's kind of found his niche at surfacing cars that you don't necessarily see in a lot of other places. The one I've picked is the Peugeot 205 GTI Tolman edition, which is Resto Mod seems to be over-egging it a little bit, but essentially it is a 205 that has been thoroughly restored and then has a light modern breathing on such that it's still recognisably a 205, but has things like posh dampers, AP brakes, a digital dash. And I've never been a big 205 fanaticist, but I kind of went, oh, especially when it's so clean as well and it's been breathed on.
It looked really good. It had perfect stance. You know, the gap between the top of the wheels and the wheel arch was absolutely perfect. I'm not a French hot hatch fetishist in any sense of the word. I kind of missed out on that when I was growing up. I didn't have one. I have no particular love for the 205, but it does look really cool. It is classic Restomod expensive. I think, over 100K? I think if you go to them and say, I want one and here is a rusty old 205, please turn it into something nice.
Yeah, if you want one that's lightly breathed on, it's kind of like 50-ish, I think.
Yeah.
If you want the full, strip the all the paint off, repaint, reupholster.
And that's just, you're paying for somebody's time and expertise then. That
oh,
is,
God, yes.
You're looking at lots of money because it's restoring an old car.
It's a lot of time.
That's the same for all of these things. It's a lot
Absolutely.
Of money. But if you are well-to-do and you loved 205s when you were a kid or you were growing up and you fancy something different than the norm, it does look like a really cool car. And you're right, Henry's video does highlight something that you're not going to see everywhere else. It's not going to be doing the rounds of all the normal automotive producers. You're not going to see Matt Watson drag racing this against a Formula One car and a jet engine or something. I'm not quite sure. I did enjoy this, and I'm very much looking forward to the next video from him and Haggerty. Let's move on swiftly to your video and possibly channel choice for this product.
Yes. So my video choice is from a channel called Downey Live, which I don't know if I've mentioned it to you before. I think I may have done when you possibly weren't well and bedridden. So it's hosted by a Canadian guy, I think it is, called Mike Downey, who has a real thing for trains. He goes on trains, various forms of transport, but particularly trains, goes on these great train journeys. And he's really nice. He's a nice bloke who just clearly enjoys what he's doing. He's not one of these YouTuber influence, hi guys kind of people. He's just a nice bloke having a nice time doing things that he really likes that mostly involve trains. He, at the end of last season, took a trip to Abu Dhabi, I think, and watched the F1 from the cheap seats. And then the Alpine F1 team, God bless them, gave him a VIP pass for the Canadian Grand Prix. And he basically does what any fan would do and just spends the whole time going, wow, this is amazing. He does point out that what he got, because he got a team pass from Alpine, he didn't get any of the paddock club stuff. He doesn't get any of the posh stuff. He's literally basically bouncing back and forth between team hospitality and the garage, which is incredibly cool. And he's gracious with it. He's enthusiastic. He shares it brilliantly. Well worth a watch. And if you like trains, go and watch the rest of his stuff, because the number of his videos that I've watched and go, now I want to go across Canada on a train for 72 hours because it just looks amazing.
Yeah, I'm always like that with that in general. That's just a background state for me.
I want to go on trains.
Yep, pretty much.
My channel is actually from the Motor Film Awards nominations. It's a channel called Misha on Wheels, or as I've just noticed, I've put it into our notes.
In the show docs, it says Whirls.
Whirls. Misha on Whirls. He's at 17,000 subscribers at the moment, so he's a relatively small channel. Yeah, he's a Swiss YouTuber who has production value for years. Everything I've watched of his channel is beautifully shot. I think he possibly needs a bit of time and a bit of experience on the editorial side, but I think this channel is just going to get bigger and bigger and bigger. Like I say, everything is phenomenally well shot, and I think will be one to watch for the future. What are your YouTube picks for this episode?
Well, I have chosen, I think you mentioned Larry Chen's work with Haggerty on previous podcasts, his Capturing Car Culture series. And I really enjoyed a recent video of his, Crazy Rich Asians and Secret Car Collections, which has, he's done a series of videos on how unbelievably difficult and expensive it is to own a performance car in Singapore, with the tax requirements and paperwork are absolutely monstrous. But there are plenty of very well-to-do, very hard-working petrol heads in Singapore, and this video kind of goes into some of the people. There's a guy who's got like six beautifully mint Evo, Mitsubishi Evos of various generations, some track cars, some road cars, all beautifully turned out and parked in his living space. There's you go down the road to some secret hideout for some guy who used to be all over the place and then has gone very quiet, and you'll find LaFerraris covered in dust, and
oh god,
it's a fascinating view into a world that I would never have thought existed, and it's a testament to Larry Chen's everyman relatability and passion for Japanese car culture and Japanese cars, I think, in particular. Oh. He's very well known for that kind of thing. That he gets invites, you know, via his fixer in Singapore, but gets to come and see this stuff that probably nobody else would see.
Oh, God, no.
It's a really, really great video. I'd recommend, I mean, Chris has recommended watching his stuff on Haggerty before, but I really, really enjoyed this, and it got me watching a bunch of his other stuff. I generally don't tend to watch a lot of his stuff because I just get really cross at how good a photographer he is and how rubbish my stuff is by comparison. See also his Instagram channel. But I thoroughly enjoyed this. Really, really worth a watch. And if you do like seeing kind of secret car collections in very modern housing, then it is absolutely up your street. And for my channel, I have gone for Driftworks again because they've been posting a bunch of really interesting stuff on one of the co-owners of Driftworks, Phil, and his BMW E30 M3 with an E92 M3 V8 engine in it, converting that to use a sequential shifter from a DSG, trying to solve the problems of getting a steering rack that will work, fitting it into the E30 sort of chassis and undershell, all the crazy deep engineering that they're going into. You know, videos where they're trying to figure out how to solve various steering geometry issues with the car, and, you know, going and fabricating extra things on suspension uprights and so on. It's so geeky and nerdy. I love it. And also trying to get his other M3 project, which is a E46 M3 with an E60 M5 V10 engine in it.
And the most ridiculous exhaust manifold.
Yes, he's got an exhaust manifold that is a 10:1, which is a work of art in itself, and it's what that car is going to be known by. It's just this,
oh God,
sort,
yes,
of spaghetti into a single monster 4-inch outlet that they've kind of got at the moment. It's bananas, and the struggles of getting that working again. Again, I find it really engaging. It makes me go, oh, I kind of want an M4, an M3 again. But yes, really, really enjoying those. So I'm, in lieu of finding a new channel, I'm going to say go and check out Driftworks stuff. They also have a t-shirt, which I really want, which is the Big Dish Energy.
Yes.
For Dish Wheels. And I am a noted lover of Big Dish Wheels. When we were at the Intercooler podcast reporting, they had a Singer DLS. And that has possibly the deepest dish rear wheels I have seen on a car. And they were mega. It's like 12 inches of deep dish, which
it's
is
crazy.
Indeed Big Dish Energy.
It is.
So I had to be very careful enunciating that after a few whiskeys. So I think that brings us to the end of another episode,
yes,
of the Automovie Podcast. We're rolling in at 1 hour 35 before the edit. Thank you very much for listening, and please do tell your friends about the podcast, and we will try and do more of them more regularly. I know we always promise that, and we always mean it, and sometimes life gets in the way, but we will be back quicker than the last 6 weeks were, or whenever.
Definitely.
It was. Definitely back sooner than that. Yes, like, comment, subscribe, all those good YouTuber things, and I think we are going to disappear off and start gaming to win a competition so that we can go LMP3 racing in 2013 at Le Mans.
Until next time, everyone. We'll